ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this meeting. And the attendance is not large, as you know, but that doesn't matter. I hope we can have a very fruitful discussion, and I hope that you'll be given some information that will help you. We know that we've had the trials in this part of the world for the last few years, and the experiment has been extended for another 3 years by the department, the government's department, and I think people want to know as much as possible about what is happening and what is the response to what is happening as well. And so tonight we've got a lot of people who are very well informed, and I hope that those who want information will be able to ask them all sorts of questions. It's a very free and open meeting. And first of all, I'm going to ask Ricardo, who's sitting beside me, who is very highly versed in all this, with her own training and with her own knowledge, and she is very much involved, not just in this country, but internationally with her work. And so I'm very pleased to welcome you, Ricardo, to the meeting, and let you now address the... So, Ricardo, you can start.
I shall do so. I think I'll use it as the background, the PowerPoint presentation, but of course this is a rather small, font size. I mean, it's just, one can't see it well. So if we think we want to move closer, fine, but I'll try to just use it as a background anyway. And also, for me, although this evening is about GM, for me, it's been interesting to hear the debate, how much it is actually involved with the argumentation that it will feed the world. That is always said again, that we need GM because otherwise we'll starve. And yet we know that agriculture, all the hope we have, and is that there will be enough food, good food, for everyone. Not just in this country, but in Africa, or in Asia, or in Germany, or wherever. And basically, the task we have is to grow it in such a way that it will not worsen the situation, but at least stabilize, but make it even better, so that we have better biodiversity, that, for example, the footprint of agriculture in climate change is quite enormous. Not just the transport, that it is, you know, being sort of carried from South America, like most of the animal feed will come from South America to Europe. So there is a lot of travel involved, a lot of food, but also the footprint of the nitrates in it, because the nitrous gases are much more negative for the climate than even CO2. So we have this big question, what do we do? Where do we go? Do we go more technological? Do we go high-tech? Do we go GM? Do we go intensification? Or what do we do? So I'm trying to address the GM aspect within that context. And please hurry me on if I'm too slow. I was just trying to recap the situation as we have it at present, is that we have a very strong pressure on natural resources, the reduced availability and quality of water. I mean, a lot of it is used for industry. A lot of it is also used, for example, now for biofuels productions, for large-scale agriculture, which is irrigated rather than using different... ways of keeping the water in the ground. So the quality of water, availability of water, degraded soils and landscapes, loss of biodiversity and agroecosystem functions, it's going rapidly. For example, I mentioned it in South America, like Argentina, for example, where a lot of the GM soya is being grown. It's just most local people will call it now, if there is the local people, will call it the green desert, because there is nothing but soya. It's a lot of single input, and basically the whole tradition they had of food production one of the a friend of mine who is an agronomist, he said, like, within one generation, all knowledge about farming, producing the right food for the area, is gone. Because the small farms don't exist any longer. The people all went to the big cities, live often in the slums now, because it's all turned into this big business of soya production. So we can see, like, that a lot of things are disappearing. And people might think, oh, so what's the problem? But these agroecosystems also fulfill a function on top of that, which often is microclimate, which is water production, maintenance, and all that. So that was a point. The other one is degradation and loss of forest cover, degraded marine and inshore fisheries, and land competition. So that's the situation we face. Land competition is not just for cities and industry. As I said, it's also for biofuel production, where we are now often hearing we need to have more biofuels in order to not have such a negative impact with our petrol use. Is it called? Is petrol, isn't it? I'm saying?
Yes.
And so there is basically a situation where now the people divide in terms of where do we go? Do we go this way? The commonly heard response is, well, what we need to do if we face all these problems is intensification. For example, a lot of chemical inputs, GM, basically narrow genetic diversity, basically focus, concentrate on the main ones, produce that, have uniformity, because that will then help the processing, and so it's more intensification, confined animal feeding operations, all that. That is one side of the argument, and against that is where I also feel a much stronger leaning towards, is what I regard as the real solution is rather the diversity on all levels. Because I'll come back to that later, that biodiversity or diversity actually is a stabilizing factor, because if we have, for example, crops that have a multiple capacity for resistance, they're not uniform, but they might, for example, some of them might resist one pest, others might resist another pest, or some might resist drought, others not. That is, for example, like how the Ethiopians, their grain theft is not a single line breed. It's like they keep collecting it, so it's like a quite diverse grain the farmer will hold in her or his hands when they sow it, and then quite a number will survive when it's drought or when it's too much water. So diversity is actually very much a guarantee for survival and for systems to be buffered. Then interactive small-scale approach, multifunctionality. I want to show you a little. What's the next slide I wanted to go to? Just briefly, before I go to the next slide, the question is, so how do we get now the most food from a limited piece of land, if that's our task? Some will say it's these top three, agricultural practices, that's crucial, or the inputs, fertilizers, chemicals. Fertilizers doesn't need to be chemical. It can, of course, also be from organic use. So I'm not differentiating here. Or others will say the seeds, the varieties, that's what we need to focus on. That is one of the GM ways as well. It's also been part of the Green Revolution, where basically seeds are trained in such a way that they will react to certain stresses or to certain inputs in certain ways. In this case, with the Green Revolution, it was that seeds were pushed selected that they would respond to fertilizers. So they would grow more and more if they were given fertilizers. And therefore, it was not actually a high-yield crop as such, but the more proper name is a high-response crop. Because as soon as the farmer didn't have all the inputs, these seeds produce actually very badly. But a thing people often don't talk about is another component, which is like, it's as important, what is it grown with? And for us, often it is not very immediate that we see the what that factor is doing here. But there is something which is called a land equivalent ratio. I will not often use terminology, but that is one of these things. It's LER, land equivalent ratio. Basically, what it's trying to do is like you take a piece of land. And you say, I'm growing maize here, and you take the same slot, the same size, next to it, and grow beans on it, for example. And then you add both of them up in terms of what they produced. Then, in the parallel experiment, you don't keep the maize here and the beans there, but you use the whole field and you intercrop them. You mix them. And so what one might think, okay, you get the same result. But it's not true. What actually happens is often that you get up to the factor of 1.8, double as much sometimes even, the outcome. Because there's mutual support between the plants. They help each other. So that is an extreme increase of food production, which is possible. But of course, you can't put everything together. You need to know what you can plant together, in which quantities and in which timing. So there is a lot to learn, and there is research there, but of course that doesn't get much of the funding. Of course, the other thing is you can't use that system if you want to use these big machines that just, what is this called, these combine harvesters, like you have them in the US, the big ones. You can't use that system. This would be much more demanding in terms of agricultural skill and people input. But as I said, in many countries, people who actually wanted to do the farming, they don't have land any longer. So there's enough people who actually would be able to use that if there was more support for it. And it can increase the food production tremendously. So I could, for example, there is a scientific reference for those of you who want it. That in Brazil, sort of root vegetables were grown together with onions, and compared to the monocultures, the monoculture needed 50% more land in order to grow the same amount as if, like, when you grow it together. There's different examples. I am not going to go into it now. Other authors, for example, also said that if you use organic or so-called agroecological farming, meaning you produce your own manure as well, you use everything that's around you, and you do really sort of an agricultural practice that is supporting the plant in the south, you could produce 80% more with that than using conventional agriculture. And these are reports that are out, and are coming, more and more of them are coming out. Sort of, for example, the UNEP, United Nations program, others. So, and that is where again, I'm coming back to that point, agricultural crossroads, because now I'm coming back to the GM aspect. Is there a role in all of that for GM? I'll come back later, towards the end of my my talk, come back to the organic agriculture, not organic, the non-GM agriculture, and how people in the south actually produce food despite droughts and other adversities. But we are being told often that, well, GM has a very strong contribution to give. There is something which is a central tenet, of German agriculture, which says the use of genetic modification in agriculture is a natural extension of traditional breeding. You might have heard that. Of traditional breeding methods, but more precise, faster, and safer. That is quite often said. Another statement is, genes are isolated units of information that can function in totally predictable manner, even when moved between unrelated species and using the GM technology. Well, I've basically already stated underneath that both these premises, both these statements are actually not correct. And I'll show you now briefly why. So basically, they are not precise, they are not faster, they are slower, and they are less safe. And genes don't function in isolation, you can't just move them around. I used to work for a long time in the Royal Free Hospital in London, running a laboratory on human gene therapy. If things would work according to that, we would have had ways to use human gene therapy to help people, for example, with hemophilia, that's what I was doing, the bleeding disease, blood clotting disease, then all this would work. Then we would have results, then it would be much further, but it doesn't. So therefore, quickly, for those of you who are not well-versed in what kind of sizes we are talking about, looking in a plant, looking at a leaf, in the leaf you find all the cells, obviously, in the middle of the cells, where is it? You'll find the nucleus, which is like where all the information is stored, where all is basically the command center of the cell. And in that you have all the long spaghetti-like DNA strands. And on these strands, which is called DNA, the chromosomes, you see these red little units, these are genes. So you can see there's much more than just genes there, but in old times people thought like it's junk DNA, the rest, but now we know actually it's all of it is very important. So that is that size, but even smaller, this is the level often you might hear about, is the, where the individual letters are, the AACT, that's how the spelling is. On that level, it is linear, you can see. When you actually go to that level in the nucleus, it's not linear at all. It's folded many times and folded again. It means like it's in a multiple way three-dimensional, that it interacts with each other. So just thinking of it as a linear molecule that we have to deal with is, again, mistaken. Because sometimes what happens is that you have a gene here, and you have something right over there over the, at the door. But the way it folds is that they'll be next to each other. There's a big loop somewhere, but they're next to each other and influence each other. But that's how it works. But if we just think linear, they seem to be miles apart and not interacting. So there's a... Therefore, if we put something into the DNA of a plant or of an animal, it doesn't matter, it will have effects way beyond the gene itself, the trait itself we put in. I won't go through all of this. This is just trying to state that all these different information patterns which are there in the DNA, they are all interacting, they're all co-involved. You have to think of it almost like it's an ecosystem there that functions in the same way as like gardeners would know that plants interact. It's the same way genes will do so, and therefore, again, a single gene will never be able to do its task in isolation. It will always do it in combination. And I've had experiments where I would take a gene from one organism and put it in into my test organism, and it would do something completely different than in the original one, because the context was all of a sudden different. So even famous people like Craig Venter, you might have heard of him, maybe not, he is in bio, he said, in everyday language, the talk is about a gene for this and a gene for that. We are now finding that that is rarely so. The number of genes that work in that way can almost be counted on your fingers, because we are just not hardwired in that way. And yet, you get it also with the potatoes here again. They've put like a gene in for this and a gene in for that. was actually the way it works is much more complex. Briefly, you use a gene, you have a regulatory sequence in front of it and an ending signal for the gene. That is like a gene construct. That's what you try to then get into the plant, for example. Now, how do you get it in? That is important now, because I'm trying to say that we should not just look at the trait. We should look at the whole mechanism of genetic modification. How do we get it in? How do we transform the plant? And where do we want it in there? If we could be precise, where should we put the gene in? Do we know enough about all this long strand that we would know where it's safe to put or good to put? We don't. But how do we get it in? Okay, what is being done in two ways? Either we put it on a bacterium that can invade the plant or the cells of the plant. It's an agrobacterium. Or it's put on a little gold particle, which then can be shot into the cells of the plant. In this case, the potato cell tissue was being used, and then this methodology, the agrobacterium, was used as a shuttle. And then you could just see randomly it will integrate, and I actually summarized what happens here is no control of where the gene will insert itself. There's random integration. There's imprecision, because quite often you get extra superfluous DNA, like from the bacterium itself or from backbones, from other components, or you get like just shorter chunks of it. On top of that, you get hundreds to thousands of mutations. That means you get real injuries. And our group worked quite a bit on that and the publications for that. And as a consequence, this is sort of the work we are involved with. Basically, what happens is this methodology gives injuries plus when you grow the cells back up into a plant, because it's so-called tissue culture. And in that, again, because so many chemicals are put into it, it actually is mutagenic, and therefore more injuries occur. Not all of them are negative or have a toxic or anything like it, but they need to be looked at. So therefore, to say it's more precise and it's faster or it's safer is not true at all, because now also what starts is you have to actually get rid of all these extra injuries and mutations. How do you do that? Well, the only way to do it is like by back crossing, which of course with potatoes is very, 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 very difficult, because usually it's only tubers which are being kept and used, so there is no way to actually get rid of all the injuries in it. Therefore, the risk assessment, the way it's being performed, to say we do not expect any negative effects from that gene being introduced is assumption work, but it's not scientific, and therefore we can't. I could give you examples, things that have gone wrong, for example that the genes can switch themselves off again depending on the promoter you are using. For example, this one, the cauliflower mosaic virus promoter, quite often is part to problems. It's also being used in the potato you have in the fields here. Other examples are that, for example, crops will, like the soya, will produce all of a sudden much more lignin. Lignin, you might not know, is the stuff in wood, which makes wood very hard, very tough. So you think that, what does it have to do with herbicide tolerance? And there's nothing it has to do with it. It's a side effect. And in that case, farmers lost whole crops, whole yields in one hot summer because of that particular thing. So I don't want to go through all these different things which have gone wrong, but rather leave time for questions. The implications and risks, they can go on various levels. many levels on health or gene foreign contamination, which, for example, for beekeepers is very important. The environment, biodiversity and agrobiodiversity is also very important in terms of which insects will live there, which insects can survive. You know, will it be the beneficial ones? Will it be the predator ones? Will it be the pests? What is happening at which level? So it's very crucial. And sustainable agriculture, we find that most of the GM methods being used so far and crops developed actually are counter to sustainable agriculture. For example, the BT, the crops which have an insecticide inbuilt, were grown cotton crops. Now, at first it worked, and what happened then is secondary pests came along, which had never been there before, and they took over. And that was much harder to deal with, because other farmers who didn't have GM now had to deal with two pests, the main one from before and the new one on top of it. So finally, just in case you're interested, so like, where would we go now if we wanted to have sustainable agriculture? Because one of the arguments often is, well, for example, look at Africa. The maize crops are decimated by, for example, the corn borer or the stem borer. And it's true, in East Africa, a lot of the crop is being lost to that pest. But scientists at Lake Victoria sort of said, like, okay, hold it, let's see, how can we deal with that? Isn't there a plant that maybe that pest likes better? Or a plant that the pest maybe doesn't like and that could push it away. So they researched for all the different grasses and plants they could find and developed a system that is now called the push-pull system. And what they did is they found a grass, a Napier grass, that if you plant it around the field, the stem borer just loves it. It gets attracted. But at the same time, it produces a chemical that is a sticky chemical that doesn't let go of them, that actually is a trap for them. So, therefore, they get pulled towards it and they get trapped. But at the same time, the Desmodium, the little plant they found, which they can intercrop in between, it's one of these leguminosis plants, like beans, you know, which will therefore also enrich the soil with nitrogen, but it actually sends off a chemical signal that the stem borer just doesn't like, so it stays away from the cornfield. Plus, at the same time, it has a secondary effect, that this medium, which is that a very nasty parasitic weed, which taps the roots of the maize, also doesn't like this medium, and therefore leaves the field. It doesn't infest the field. So therefore, having developed that system, all of a sudden you have like up to 70% increase in yields, and you can sell the Napier grass on the market for extra food. This is, if one wants to sort of see, here's the Napier grass at the outside, here's the maize grass, and here's the Desmodium, and here's attracted, and that pushes it away. So that is a system that is now being taught from farmer to farmer, they're passing it on. And that is a way of technology that needs to be developed, that is very, very helpful, that it can't be sold. That's a problem for those who would like to actually develop technology that will give money back to the investors directly. But for this kind of technology, everybody at the end will benefit. And other systems, you know, going back to older crops they had, asking the elders, they actually, in Kenya, where there was a huge drought, using this agroecological system, they actually managed to get out of the drought much faster and produce and could share even wider than all the others who were trying to do it with the conventional system. So for me, it's the question with research that we are doing, are we going in the right direction? That's one question. For example, the potato here. For me, the other question is, do we do the risk assessments right? That is my specialty, that's why I'm international in the negotiations. I feel with the potato field, all the questions being asked, fine, no problem. Research is an important ingredient of gaining knowledge, but there is no need for doing it in the open, where actually we do not have control over what will happen. So if you go back and have it in the glasshouse, answer questions, get all the data right, that is one thing. But then the question ultimately is also, if we are using the technology to enable us to do work a system that in itself is imploding, that is getting worse and worse, so is it just propping it up before it completely collapses then? So is that then not something we should actually say, stop, let's think again, shouldn't we go a different direction? I think that is something everybody needs to be involved in, and certainly not just we scientists, because we very often get carried away with our own research, and I think the public really has very, very important input to give there. That's all I wanted to say.